WMRA News. I'm Bob Levicky. The General Assembly's special budget session ends without agreement on a budget. Jeff Shapiro weighs in on that, plus the vote in favor of redistricting, which is now up to the state Supreme Court. And we talk with a former South Carolina governor and head of the World Food Program about his visit to a JMU forum. This is the WMRA Daily for Friday, April 24. The General Assembly met for a special session Thursday to consider a budget, but they had no budget to consider. Radio IQ's Michael Pope has the details.
As special sessions go, this one was not very special. It was supposed to be about the budget, but there was no budget document to vote on because House and Senate leaders are still at loggerheads over a data center tax exemption. The House wants to keep it. The Senate wants to ditch it. Senator Mark Peek is a Republican from Lynchburg who says even with the trifecta, Democrats still can't govern.
And we still don't have a budget. And more disappointing is we hear that the conferees are not conferring. That there really haven't been any conversations about the budget, certainly not for the public. Maybe some people are meeting with data center representatives behind closed doors, certainly not transparent.
Senate Majority Leader Scott Surovell says the governor's amendments and vetoes are casting new doubt on the budget.
Part of the problem is, the governor vetoed about $500 million out of the budget when she vetoed skill games, and the only way the House budget even balanced was with that money. So if you also start messing around with cannabis, if she vetoes cannabis, there is no cannabis money at all. So, it's hard to build a budget when you have those kinds of variables in play until we know exactly what the governor's going to do.
The House and Senate have about 2 months before the new fiscal year starts in July.
Virginians will soon have access to paid family leave, but what happens to a bill that would implement paid sick leave is up to the governor. Michael has that report.
Senator Jennifer Boysko is a Democrat from Herndon who's been trying to pass a bill creating paid family and medical leave for 8 years. This year, it's finally happening, although Governor Abigail Spanberger made some changes lawmakers accepted this week. One of them has to do with how long some people can take advantage of the new program.
In a domestic violence, unsafe situation, an individual under our bill would be able to take 12 weeks off to take care of themselves. When the governor looked across the country at other policies for paid family and medical leave that include a safety leave proponent, there was only 4 weeks granted.
So that amendment was accepted, but lawmakers rejected an amendment on a separate bill requiring employers to offer paid sick days. The governor's amendment would have created an exemption for pilots and flight crew. So now the governor is reconsidering the previous unamended version of the bill, which was introduced by Senator Barbara Favola, a Democrat from Arlington.
I would say to the governor that most of her amendments can probably be done through regulation. And I would say that the pilots and the flight crew deserve the protection of this bill.
The governor now has a decision to make about paid sick days, sign the bill, veto it, or allow it to become law without her signature. Reporting from the Capitol in Richmond, I'm Michael Pope.
State Senator Russet Perry, a Loudoun County Democrat, proposed a bill that would make it more expensive for local governments to use eminent domain and claim land under a conservation or open space easement. She says that land is often targeted for infrastructure projects because a lack of development devalues it.
We meant what we said when we said these areas are worth preserving. And so if you want to go in there, you're going to have to pay back that tax revenue that the citizens of the locality, the citizens of the Commonwealth forewent.
The General Assembly rejected Governor Spanberger's amendment Wednesday and then approved the original bill with a bipartisan supermajority. That's a rare move that veto-proofs the pending law, and it will go into effect on July 1st. Virginia's Democratic Speaker of the House did not have kind words for Democrats who voted no in the recent redistricting referendum, Radio IQ's Brad Kuttner reports.
We know that was close because there are some Democrats, some squishy bedwetting Democrats who they don't want to, you know, they claim, oh, well, I don't like gerrymandering. This is not about gerrymandering.
That's House Speaker Don Scott Wednesday morning after the redistricting effort he and Senate President Louise Lucas, both Democrats of color, threw their full weight behind, won by a nearly 3-point margin. Scott's harsh words didn't come out of nowhere. He said voters in districts like his and Lucas's, majority black and brown, and near Naval Station Norfolk, felt the impacts from President Donald Trump's policies more than most.
We have a guy sending our men and women into war.
Delegate Jackie Glass's Norfolk district is demographically comparable to Lucas and Scott's. It also voted overwhelmingly for redistricting to benefit Democrats. Glass had words for no voting Democrats as well.
The fact that you are able to exercise those moral principles is because of the work that we're going to be, that we have done right here with the Yes campaign. That, quite frankly, was led, executed, and pushed through by black folks, by women, and those who share that, both of those identities.
Brian Cannon was among Democrats who were part of the No Gerrymandering Virginia effort. He said he'll still vote for Democrats despite Scott's comments, but he also stands by his vote.
Democrats to win the House don't need to cheat.
Cannon's wish could still come true. A Republican-backed challenge to the redistricting effort will be argued at the Supreme Court of Virginia on Monday. In Richmond, I'm Brad Cutner.
Well, there's been movement in the fights over redistricting and the state budget, but neither has reached a conclusion, politics analyst Jeff Shapiro. And Michael Pope recapped the week in politics and state government.
All right, a lot of news to get to this week, starting with redistricting. So Tuesday was the big vote when voters approved this constitutional amendment. But then the next day, a judge out in Tazewell County ruled that the State Board of Elections cannot certify the election because of legal doubts. Meanwhile, Monday, the Supreme Court of Virginia is going to be hearing oral arguments about all these objections. Jeff Shapiro, what can we look forward to with these oral arguments on Monday?
First of all, we need to call this redistricting. This is an anti-Trump gerrymander pushed by Democrats as a remedy to the anti-democratic gerrymander pushed by Trump in Republican-led states. All of this an attempt to retain Republican control of the House of Representatives. When the Virginia Supreme Court green-lighted this referendum, it also said that it would be taking up the statutory and constitutional issues. Among them, most recently argued, whether these artistically drawn boundaries are consistent with the Constitution standards that districts be compact, contiguous, and reflect shared communities of interest. So it is entirely possible that seven justices, many of whom were elected by Republican-dominated legislatures, could reverse the results of a referendum in which the voters of Virginia narrowly approved this scheme described by opponents as troubling. P.S., it is not unprecedented for the Virginia Supreme Court to throw out congressional boundaries, as it did in 1932, 3 weeks before an election.
So the Virginia General Assembly was back in session this week to consider more than 100 amendments sent down by the governor. What were some of the big ones?
This was an exercise by the governor in proposing these amendments, in independence, an attempt to sort of restore her centrist image. The bills that got the greatest attention include the governor's proposed delay in the launch of a commercial cannabis market, a delay of a year. The Democrats in the Assembly are not interested in that, nor are they interested in delaying by a year opening up the public workforce to union rights, collective bargaining privileges. These are articles of faith with liberal Democrats. And the governor now has two choices. These bills are returned to her in their original form. She can sign them. She can veto them. She has 30 days to do so. There is another option. She could allow some of these bills to become law without her signature. So the clock is ticking.
So the General Assembly also had a special session this week to consider the budget, but it wasn't all that special because there is no budget. The deadline is this summer. Jeff Shapiro, are they going to meet their deadline?
Well, this is what we're told by the chairs of the Money Committee, Luke Torian, who leads the House Budget Committee, and Louise Lucas, who leads the Senate Budget Committee. They are far apart on a number of issues, most notably continued tax breaks, multi-billion-dollar tax breaks for data centers. Some of the legislation that was back before the Assembly, including this cannabis bill, have revenue components about which Senator Lucas feels particularly strongly. So there's a big hole to fill up, a multi-billion-dollar hole, and there's a June 30th deadline to do so.
All right, that's all the time that we've got for this week. My name is Michael Pope, and we have been joined by politics analyst and UVA scholar Jeff Shapiro. Talk to you next week.
Ciao.
David Beasley is the former governor of South Carolina and most recently served as the executive director of the United Nations World Food Program, which was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize under his leadership. He will speak at James Madison University's ROCCO Forum on the Future later today. WMRA's Calvin Penn asked Beasley how his time as governor prepared him for humanitarian work.
Governors historically have the experience of addressing issues and doing what's necessary to achieve the objectives that you need. And so in the World Food Program's job, I got a phone call, would I be interested in it? And I said, absolutely not. I'm not looking for a job. And quite frankly, I didn't know much about the World Food Program. But a group of Democrat and Republican U.S. senators said, you've got to do this. You're the only one that could, you know, talk the Trump administration and not to cutting foreign aid. And you're the only one that can, you know, do this and do that, et cetera. I'm like, guys, I'm not looking for a job. Well, anyway, I got talked into it. And quite frankly, it's the greatest job I've ever had in my life, saving the lives of millions of people around the world. But the experiences as governor that you have brought to the table, the ability to be able to communicate a message, to build a team, execute a plan, address the issues, and bring awareness globally to the leaders of the world of the travesty that's taking place because of people not getting the food they need, from starvation to mass migration to destabilization. And we can talk all about that. But being a former United States governor with those experiences of dealing with complex and heated issues gives you the background that's necessary in a job like that.
Your term was extended because there was the COVID-19 pandemic and the war in Ukraine. Well, how did it feel to continue that term with these new problems arising?
When I took the job back in 2017, there were only 80 million people, as we would say, marching to starvation, not knowing where the next meal is coming from. So I'm thinking, as a former United States governor, we set goals, objectives, benchmarks, measurables, execute a plan. I could put the World Food Program out of business with, you know, 7.6 billion population at that time. And so after the first year, the number went from 80 to 135 million people. And you step back and say, what happened? War, conflict, violence, climate shocks. And this is before COVID hit. COVID then comes on the scene, and the number jumps from 135 to 276 million people marching to starvation around the world. Then when you think it can't get any worse, guess what happens? The breadbasket of the world is invaded by Russia as to Ukraine. And so the number jumped from 276 to 350. 50 million people. So it was just getting worse and worse and worse. And so I was having to, you know, raise the clarion call to leaders around the world. You're going to have deep mass destabilization, mass migration. We've got to do something about it. And so we went from raising a little less than $6 billion to over $14 billion to reach 160 million people, you know, in about 100 countries around the world, which stabilized the populations, prevented mass migrations and war and conflict. And so it's a tremendous success story. But now let's roll the tape forward. And here we are. All oil prices are spiking, which means fertilizer costs, fuel costs for operating farming equipment, logistics, supply chain systems. They're all spiking at increased costs. You couple that with what we're facing today, compound that with the fact the United States and other major donor nations around the world are cutting foreign aid dramatically. You are facing what I consider to be, you know, a hellacious hurricane coming. I mean, a devastation storm of the century is coming and going to be taking place. It's going to be travesty in the next year.
What is the message that you're hoping to convey at Friday's event?
It's going to be an opportunity to talk to the American people about the reality that we are facing. And today, what I have seen around the world, when people stop talking to one another and they start fighting one another, and they don't do the things they need to do, and the nation's destabilized, what I see in America today, the trajectory that we're on is the wrong path, because we're more divided than any time period in world history. And so how do we, and what do we do to move America in the right direction? And that's what I'm going to talk about, because the American people, by and large, are the most gracious, giving, good people I've met anywhere on the planet. But right now, everybody's fighting one another on social media, and it's absolutely out of control. And so what are we going to do about it? And that's one of the things I want to talk to the American people about. Look, when Democrats and Republicans are fighting each other like they are, it's up to we, the people, to do what's good, to do what's right, loving our neighbor, caring for one another. We can find solutions. We can find a path forward.
David, thank you so much for taking the time to talk today, and we're looking forward to your visit on Friday.
You got it. Thanks, Gavin.
Full disclosure, WMRA's operating license is held by JMU's Board of Visitors. You can hear a longer version of this conversation and links to more information at WMRA.org and on our app. Tomorrow, Saturday, is the National Prescription Drug Take-Back Day. From 10 a.m. to 2 p.m., unwanted or expired prescription and over-the-counter medications in tablet, capsule, or patch forms will be accepted at local collection sites, with all identifying information removed. Liquids such as cough syrup should be securely sealed in their original containers. To find your local collection site, visit DEATakeback.com. Finally today, the day Virginians went to the polls on redistricting, another vote was taking place at the Virginia Marine Resources Commission. It was on a fourth petition questioning whether there is enough menhaden in the Chesapeake Bay. Radio IQ's Pamela D'Angelo reports.
Tanya O'Connor says it wasn't her intention to take on a village. Among the hundreds of written comments by Reedville's multi-generational menhaden fishing family names was a retired math teacher, a 911 operator, an electrician, and a manager of a boat building company. At the meeting, Russell Ferguson spoke on behalf of the 120 hourly employees who work at the plant in Reedville.
Our hours worked are directly determined by the amount of fish that's brought to the dock. I would like to ask this commission that you not limit any of the fishing season in the Chesapeake Bay. This would have a drastic effect on our families and on our livelihoods.
But O'Connor focused on the lack of data that would determine if there was localized depletion from industrial fishing.
I'm talking about the law. You know, it's not because I don't care about jobs.
VMRC uses data scientists have collected for the entire Atlantic coast to make its management decisions. According to the last 2023 study, menhaden are not being overfished. But O'Connor and three organizations that have petitioned before her and failed want specific data for the Chesapeake Bay, the nation's largest estuary. Estuaries are nature's nurseries. Other Atlantic coast states have closed industrial fishing in their bays.
Ask not even a fifth grader or a third grader, right? We're going to issue these permits for industrial fishing. Like, how much fish should we give away? Again, they would ask, well, how much fish are there?
The commissioners voted 6-2 against the petition. From Hampton, I'm Pamela D'Angelo.
For WMRA News, I'm Bob Levicky. Thanks for listening, and I hope you enjoy your Friday.